Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our book pick segment. And it is a pleasure to have you here. I love this segment, and I so enjoy talking to our my dear friends who are the booksellers of these wonderful independent bookstores throughout our region. They come bearing incredible gifts for all of us in the sense of ideas and books that we can enjoy, read, and explore. We welcome Connie Brooks and Heather Boyne from Battenkill Books in Cambridge, New York. Good morning, Connie and Heather.
Wonderful. Good morning, Joe. Here. Nice
Good
to
morning.
See you.
Thank you. And Cheryl McCann is here from the Bookhouse in Albany and Market Block Books in Troy, New York. Hi.
Hello.
Nice to see you. Thank
so
you very
nice
much
be
for
here.
Being here.
Thank you.
All right. Connie, let's start with you and get to the list.
All right. I brought an eclectic list today, and I start with the novel The Listeners by Maggie Stiefvater. Stiefvater has been known up to now as a young adult author, but as many writers of adult fiction are crossing over and writing young adult books, so too are a growing number of YA authors who are now publishing in the adult realm. The Listeners is one of my favorite novels so far of 2025. It is a work of historical fiction with a touch of the paranormal tossed in. The setting is a luxury hotel in West Virginia in January of 1942. The staff of the Avalon Hotel and Spa have just been informed that they will be playing host to a number of diplomats from Germany, Italy, and Japan. And while the Avalon is a fictional hotel, the State Department did have to turn to hotels up and down the East Coast after the U.S. joined World War II. The Axis countries had not usually let our members of the diplomatic corps return to the United States, so in turn, we couldn't release their diplomats, and yet we couldn't label them prisoners because that would be awkward. So the solution was to relocate them to hotels where they would be under FBI surveillance. The arrival of the diplomats and their staff members, from secretaries to chauffeurs, throws the hotel into disarray. Amongst other complications, many of the hotel staff have husbands, brothers, and sons heading to war, so the idea of waiting on the enemy hand and foot doesn't exactly sit well. At the same time, the hotel's reputation is at stake, war or no war. I haven't even touched on the unlikely romance that develops or where the paranormal connection comes in, but trust that this is a standout read for the summer.
It is The Listeners, a novel, and we start there on this Tuesday morning for Book Picks. Heather, you're up.
All right. Anjet Donge is a pseudonym for a Dutch author, Anjet de Boer. She writes novels, short stories, and screenplays.
I'm just going to fix your microphone. Hold
oh,
on.
Oh, sorry.
I'm going to get you fitted more properly.
Ah, there we go. All right.
I apologize for the creaking.
She writes novels, short stories, and screenplays. Her novels have received top literary prizes in her native Netherlands. Her historical novel, The Remembered Soldier, was first published in 2020. New Vessel Press, a publisher specializing in fiction and narrative nonfiction, publishes this American edition. The translation is by David McKay. I was immediately drawn to this book when it arrived at the store. Perhaps it was the bold graphic cover of a photograph of a World War I soldier. Historical fiction sections in bookstores are notoriously World War II heavy, and this one stood out. The story begins in Flanders in 1922. The man is named Noon Merkham. He's a soldier who has lost his memory and has been in an asylum for 4 years. The name the staff has given him comes from the time and place he was found, noon, around lunchtime, and near the town of Merkham in Belgium. Noon is visited at the asylum by several women who have seen his description in the newspaper and are hoping that he is their missing husband. It is only when Julianne Coppens arrives and says that it is her husband, Amand, a photographer, that the doctors feel they have found his wife. After all, she provides details of a scar as proof. Still unsure of who he is, Noon, now Amand, goes home and with Julianne and tries to recover his memory. Julianne tries to fill in the blanks of his life. Sometimes he believes her, sometimes he doesn't. Amand's nights are racked with nightmares, and he continually questions who he really is. Some memories start to return, but they're not the correct memories. Julianne has memories of her own. The writing is unusual. The sentences are long and descriptive. And Jet Donge is a master of showing, not telling, allowing the readers to experience the story through actions, thoughts, senses, and feelings. There are no quotation marks to signify the exact words spoken by the characters. The run-on sentences change your reading cadence into more of a stream of consciousness. At first, I thought it was the characteristic of the translation, but it's purposeful. The technique makes you feel like you're reading the character's thoughts, and the only conversations are happening in everyone's head. Admittedly, I have not finished this book, but I do think that there could be a happy ending. How can a man who goes to war come home and pick up where he left off? Are the memories he used to have even valid, or is he so fundamentally changed by the horrors he endured that there's no going back to who he was?
All right. A lot there. The Remembered Soldier is the name of the book. Cheryl.
Well, I thought I would start with something light today, which is unusual for me.
Yeah.
This is a picture book, and the title is The Escape Artist, A True Story of Octopus Adventure by Tor Hansen, illustrated by Galia Bernstein.
All right.
In the early spring, when I was here, I brought Tor Hansen's newest nature book, Close to Home, The Wonders of Nature Just Outside Your Door. Now for his new picture book, the Washington State conservation biologist has gone farther, to New Zealand, to write the story of Inky, who escaped from his tank in the National Aquarium to the sea through a drainpipe. Now, we have heard the story of octopuses escaping before, most notably in the delightful and beloved, at this point, novel Remarkably Bright Creatures, and in Cy Montgomery's Soul of the Octopus. Hansen, whose work and very demeanor reminds me of Bill Nye combined with Fred Rogers, uses iambic pentameter rhymes to enliven this amazing tale for the youngest reader. He ends with two pages of fun facts, which could be read aloud or could be read for a little older reader, about octopuses. And he also explains that, yes, sometimes octopi is acceptable.
That is awesome. The Escape Artist, A True Story of Octopus Adventure by Tor Hansen. Terrific. All right. Connie.
I don't know about that octopus book, and now I have to have it.
Now
that
I have
looks
to
amazing.
Have it.
I'm already in love with Inky. So my next book is They Poisoned the World, Life and Death in the Age of Forever Chemicals by Mariah Blake. They Poisoned the World is the expertly researched story of PFAS contamination in the small upstate New York town of Hoosick Falls. In 2014, after losing several friends and relatives, including his father, to cancer, an insurance underwriter in Hoosick Falls, New York, began to suspect that the local water supply was polluted. When he tested his tap water, he discovered dangerous levels of per- and polyfluoral alkali substances known as forever chemicals. These PFAS have been used for decades in a wide range of products such as nonstick cookware, clothing, and makeup. But PFAS were unregulated, and there was no determination of what an unsafe amount in drinking water might be. This set off a chain of events that led to 100 million Americans learning that their drinking water was tainted and that the manufacturers of these toxic chemicals had known about their hazards for decades. Investigative journalist Blake tells the astonishing story of this cover-up, tracing its roots back to the Manhattan Project and through the post-war years, as industry scientists discovered that these chemicals were all but immune from breaking down and were accumulating in the blood of virtually every human being. Drawing on years of on-the-ground reporting and research, Blake interweaves the secret history of forever chemicals with a moving story of how a lone village and its brave residents took on the chemical giants and won.
The name of the book is They Poison the World, Life and Death in the Age of Forever Chemicals. All right, Heather.
All right. I was first introduced to Amelia Earhart through the TV program In Search Of. Does anybody remember In Search Of in the 1970s?
Of course.
Yes. The half-hour program even had a disclaimer. This series contains information in part based on theory and conjecture. And that was an understatement. The mysterious disappearance of Amelia in her Lockheed Electra airplane over the Pacific Ocean in her 1937 attempt to circumnavigate the globe was put right in the middle of other great mysteries. The Bermuda Triangle, the Loch Ness Monster. Was she kidnapped by aliens? It was a theory. So as an 11-year-old, I needed to know more about her, and that has continued to this day. Writer Lori Gwen Shapiro has uncovered more details about Amelia's life and death in her book, The Aviator and the Showman, Amelia Earhart, George Putnam, and the Marriage That Made an American Icon. So Ms. Shapiro tells the story of the 1930s power couple G.P., George Putnam, and A.E., Amelia Earhart, as she referred to herself. Amelia was an aviation pioneer. On the heels of Charles Lindbergh's transatlantic flight, the people were looking for Lady Lindy. So anxious were they that she became famous for being the first female passenger to cross the ocean by airplane. Her magnetism and celebrity were not lost on the heir to the Putnam publishing empire. George had his own taste for adventure. He went on two expeditions to the Arctic. So as editor of G. Putnam & Sons, George had worked with Charles Lindbergh on his book, We, about his transatlantic journey. And because of his success, sponsors asked him to help arranging the first ever flight by a woman across the Atlantic Ocean. It was Putnam who suggested Amelia Earhart. He published Earhart's books. He got her a spot as editor for Cosmopolitan magazine. That's right. She was the aviation editor for Cosmo magazine. She also wrote newspaper columns and essays and published books. She was a brand. She had a clothing line and a signature set of suitcases so everyone could be like her. As it turned out, George and Amelia had more than just a common interest in each other. They married in 1931. She kept her name to protect her sailability. With George's encouragement, she became the first woman to make a nonstop transatlantic flight. Now, the Magicket couple had parlayed their mutual need for adventure into fame and publishing gold. Their need to promote even more dangerous stunts led to sloppiness and overconfidence. Like Icarus, the closer you get to the sun, the more dangerous it becomes. In the spring of 1937, Amelia took off on her second attempt to circumnavigate the globe, and on her last leg, communications with her airplane were lost over the Pacific Ocean. The mystery remains to this day. That tragedy did not stop her ambitious widower from publishing the final her final book, which was supposed to be called World Flight, but he called it Last Flight. And last month, there was an announcement that Purdue University will renew their efforts to find her plane. They're going to send people out to look for her again. Almost 100 years later, maybe all of us in search of fans will finally have our answer.
Oh, if only Leonard Nimoy were around to help us, guide us through this. I know you have a book that is linked to this, right?
Yes, so I do.
It seems like we should do that now.
Okay. In a nutshell, there's a children's book, Earhart, The Incredible Flight of a Field Mouse Around the World. It was written and illustrated by Torben Kallman, and he is an award-winning illustrator who has a whole series about mouse adventures. So he does other different aviators like Lindbergh. He also did Armstrong. He does Edison and Einstein. So it's about a mouse perhaps being instrumental in that story of Amelia Earhart.
All right. Well, good stuff. And it is Earhart, The Incredible Flight of a Field Mouse Around the World, written and illustrated by Torben Kallman. All right. Cheryl.
When the Cranes Fly South by Lisa Ridzen. If any listeners have been to an independent bookstore this month, the August Indie Next flyer features When the Cranes Fly South on the cover. So those booksellers who loved this book from the get-go are very excited to see that it's getting
it's a big deal.
A well-deserved feature. It is also an original paperback, so it's very accessible. Swedish author Lisa Ridzen's this is her debut novel, and it won the 2024 Swedish Book of the Year. It's inspired by the notes that her grandfather's caregivers left as they were caring for him. It's a realistic, poignant retrospective on the last weeks of a life. 89-year-old Bo's first-person meditation during his final summer from May through October. His carer's brief perfunctory reports introduce each passage, but the rest of the passages, which are short, are Bo's vivid memories and hopes for his last days. He's lying on his daybed in his lifelong home, comforted by his faithful elk hound, Sixton. Beau asks little of his caregivers or of his son, Hans. But Hans has determined Beau can't care for the dog, and he plans to rehome him. The heartbreaking possibility of losing 610 exacerbates the rocky relationship between Beau and Hans, angering the father, but also reminding him the deal he made with himself. I don't want there to be any hard feelings between us at the end. Beau's meditations reveal a life lived with care. This novel offers a poignant look at aging and the dignity of life. It is truly a feel-good tearjerker, and there's the dog.
When the Cranes Fly South by Lisa Ridzon. That sounds terrific. Excellent. Connie.
My next one is a book called Nothing More of This Land, Community, Power, and the Search for Indigenous Identity by Joseph Lee. The island of Martha's Vineyard off the coast of Massachusetts is today known as an iconic vacation destination. But before that, it was the traditional home of the Wampanoag people. The journalist Joseph Lee begins his exploration of Indigenous identity with his own childhood, spending summers on the island, attending tribal summer camp, and learning the Wampanoag language, juxtaposed against performing tribal customs for tourists. The Wampanoag remained independent far longer than other native tribes in the region until the whaling industry took over and fundamentally transformed the island. As whaling faded, the allure of the island as a summer vacation spot increased, land prices soared, and today 3/4 of Wampanoag tribal members live off the island. In 2015, Lee finds himself drafted as a volunteer to count votes from a tribal election on the question of allowing gambling onto the island. The result is a tie. The community is split down the middle on the question, some advocating for the prospect of jobs and revenue, others worrying about the loss of land and other misgivings. While partly a coming-of-age story and exploration of Wampanoag tribal politics, Lee broadens his narrative to Indigenous communities in California, Alaska, and beyond. Exploring the work of a variety of Indigenous legal scholars and activists challenges and widens Lee's own ideas and leads him to complicated questions about sovereignty and tribal governance.
All right. It is Nothing More of This Land, Community Power and the Search for Indigenous Identity by Joseph Lee. Heather.
All right. My final book comes in the form of a public service announcement. It's the children's picture book, Don't Trust Fish, written by Neil Sharpson and illustrated by Dan Santat. It is a nature guide with a twist, a joyful read aloud that explains why fish are different than other animals. You must never, ever trust fish, our mysterious narrator implores. Other animals are simple to identify. Fish are not. They spend all of their time in the water where you can't see them. Pretty fishy, right?
Very fishy.
Yes. Some live in the fresh water, some in salt water. Some fish eat poor, innocent crabs that are just trying to have a nice time. And that may be a clue as to who is pushing all of this anti-fish propaganda. It is on the many best of lists this summer. It is sneaky science, the kind of book that kids will want to read over and over again. Don't trust fish.
They could be doing anything down
there. They could be doing anything.
Yeah, you don't know what's going on down there. Excellent. Don't trust fish. All right, Cheryl.
My next one is a novel, Parallel Lines by Edward St. Aubin. Ooh. And I have to begin with a full disclosure. I wasn't drawn to the rave reviews for this novel for its brilliant, brutal, and funny intellectual content, or the reviews that called it a drama of consciousness, or the premise of a crisscrossing of characters, including a set of adult twins who were separated at birth and meet each other in their 40s. No, I needed an audiobook.
No, there you go.
And I had this one in my queue from Libro FM, mm-hmm. and I read that this was brought to us by Benedict Cumberbatch.
Oh.
And wow. I thought, okay, this is going to be a good investment in time.
Yeah. Good endorsement there.
It is like a radio play. And most of my audio I enjoy in the car. And it's come to the point where my life is an intermission. And then I get back in the car and I get back to this wonderful, wonderful audio book. Mm-hmm. So Benedict Cumberbatch does all the voices. And hearing him very early in the novel, we meet the absurdly endearing Sebastian, whose monologues from a London hospital's suicide observation room include show tune parodies like pill cutter, cut me a pill. I was hooked. Cumberbatch reads St. Aubyn's rich, complex, often hilarious writing like the incomparable actor he is. St. Aubyn's 11th novel is a first for me, but now I know that it won't be the last.
Great. Good stuff. All right. It is called Parallel Lines by Edward St. Aubyn. Connie.
I have a middle grade novel next, which is The Trouble with Heroes by Kate Messner. It is a novel told in verse, and it is a tale about grief and the healing power of hiking and nature. 2 years ago, Finn Connolly's dad, a first responder at 9/11, and hero with a capital H, dies in his mid-40s. Finn is in a tailspin. He is about to fail seventh grade, and one night he is caught on camera vandalizing a local cemetery. It turns out that the grave he has damaged belongs to a legendary local mountain climber, and her daughter makes Finn an unusual offer. She'll drop the charges against him if he agrees to climb all 46 of the Adirondack's high peaks in a single summer. And his companion will be the late mountain climber's dog. Metaphor is rich on each page of this story as Finn confronts challenging terrain, weather, and most importantly, his own feelings about himself and measuring up to his legendary father. I love that Kate Messner doesn't shy away from challenging topics in her novels, and she handles the messiness of grief and adolescence with compassion and grace.
That sounds terrific as well. The Trouble with Heroes by Kate Messner. All right, Cheryl, I think you'll have the last word
okay.
here.
A Flower Traveled in My Blood, the incredible true story of the grandmothers who fought to find a stolen generation of children, nice. By Haley Cohen Gilliland. At more than 400 pages, this narrative history is a painful, fascinating work of the political, social, scientific, and religious factors of an extraordinary dark time in history known as the Dirty War. From 1976 to 1983, Argentina was ruled by a brutal dictatorship dedicated to instilling Western Christian values. Among the depraved actions of the junta was torturing so-called subversives, kidnapping pregnant activists, snatching their babies to give to other families, and disappearing the mothers. The widely accepted estimate is that 30,000 people were killed by the military, 500 babies were stolen. The current Argentine government refutes this number. In 1977, early on in the junta, a group of fierce grandmothers formed, the Abuelas de Plaza de Mayo, committed to finding the missing daughters and the grandbabies. They are active to this day. On July 5th, last month, baby 140, a 48-year-old Buenos Aires man, was identified following years of his sister searching for the brother she never knew. The leader of the Abuelas is now 94 years old. And in June, the group went to court to demand protection for the National Genetic Data Bank, which had helped in this case but has been left largely paralyzed by current budget cuts of the Argentine government. This is a period of history which I was rather surprised to know many people had not heard of and which cannot be forgotten.
Wow. A Flower Traveled in My Blood by Haley Cohen Gilliland. Is that right?
I think so.
Okay. Yeah. Excellent. We didn't get to everything there, but you can see the complete list on our website, wamc.org/roundtable. And in, no, we don't even have time for that. I was going to ask you for other things. I apologize. wamc.org/roundtable. Check out the wonderful websites of each bookstore, battenkillbooks.com. And also, you can go to bhny.com for the bookhouse and Market Block books. Thank you all very much.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.